still rocking after all these years.
This is the story of my rock and roll butler.
This is it, the show that started it all. Often imitated, but never equal. From San Francisco, USA, online since 2004, right. It's the one and only Rock and Roll Geek Show. With the original Rock and Roll Geek, Michael Butler.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. My name is Michael Butler. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. I am very happy to have on my arch nemesis. No, I'm kidding. My friend BJ Cramp. How you doing, BJ?
Hey, I'm good, Michael. How are you?
I'm super great. Couldn't be better. Thanks for asking. Well, hold on. Let me open up the first beer. I'm sorry I'm late for this thing. I've had a rough morning. I was hunting this morning. And that's a long story that I'll go into a later time. Then I had to drive an hour away. I'm up in the mountains, and I'm taking a diving class tomorrow, and I had to get all the gear, and this fucking guy showed up an hour late. So let me take a sip of this. Mm-hmm. I'm ready for a beer.
Is that a fine Tecate?
It's a fine Pacifico.
Okay.
On sale for $17, a 12-pack. So the reason BJ is on the show is because he's got a book, a very ambitious book, I should say, BJ, called This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick. Is this your first book, BJ?
My first book published.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you've written other books.
Well, I've tried.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the other books?
Oh, you know, I've tried my hand at novels and stuff like that. Screenplays.
Oh, screenplays. Yeah. Did you send them to any, like, TV shows or stuff like that?
Yeah, I've had little nibbles, but nothing. Oh, yeah.
What kind of show did you submit the stuff to?
Do you know who Frank Caliendo is?
Frank
Caliendo. Comedian.
Yeah, I've heard the name. Also, you tried writing. Well, he has a. Go ahead.
Well, I have known him since like kindergarten. So, at one point, he hooked me up with a producer, who said he wanted to read one of my screenplays. But then it was the kind of situation where I don't think the guy ever even read it. He asked me to send it to him, and then that was the end of it. No.
Yeah. What was the
That's
screenplay?
That's kind of how that stuff.
What was the screenplay? Was it that? Was it a episode of Friends?
No, it was actually a movie. Oh. It was a movie about a guy who travels back in time and saves Elvis Presley.
Oh, nice. That sounds like Bubba Ho-Tep a little bit.
Yeah, it was before Bubba Ho-Tep when I first started writing it. But yeah, you know. That's also how that kind of stuff works, is something always ends up coming out that is close to your idea. It's like there's only so many ideas in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like a song.
It's always the danger, yeah.
And how many novels did you write?
Oh, well, I've never finished one.
Yeah.
But
well, to get a book done is a huge undertaking. I started one and I gave up because I realized that I can't write. So this book, quite ambitious. I mean, this is like did you ever read that book Trouble Boys about the Replacements?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that thing's like a friggin' War and Peace of the Replacements. This is pretty up there. How many pages are there? Over 375 pages in this book. Quite the undertaking. So congratulations on being able to do this.
Thank you.
Is it self-published or you have a publisher?
No, it's a publisher called Jawbone. They're out of the UK.
Okay.
They mostly do music books. You know, they have a book about Randy Rhoads. They published that book about Cliff Burton. Last year or 2 years ago, they had the book about King's X. They have a lot of music books.
So did you approach them and send them the entire manuscript, or how did it work?
Yeah, there's a guy named Stephen Roth who did marketing for them. He actually worked for a different company, but they were associated with Jawbone. And he's the first person who recommended that I contact and put me in touch with the editor there, like the guy who actually decides what books Jawbone's going to publish. His name is Tom. And Jawbone is really one of the only publishers that you can submit to without having an agent.
Uh-huh.
The other one is ECW, that published Van Halen Rising. So otherwise you have to go through an agent and all of that. And I don't have an agent. So they asked to see a couple chapters. I sent a couple chapters, then they asked to see a couple more.
Huh.
And yeah, by the time I was talking to them, I had a version of the book mostly finished. It's a very different book now than it was then. But
is the guy who wrote Van Halen Rising, what's
Greg Renoff?
Greg Renoff. Does he have an agent? He probably does.
Yeah,
now.
He didn't. Yeah, he didn't when he published Van Halen Rising, but then he did get an agent after that.
So now,
and then he did the Ted Templeman book.
Yeah, now that you have this book, do you have an agent yet?
No, the book comes out September 6th, and I don't know if somebody's going to contact me or what. I mean, I'm already thinking about what I'm going to do next, but, you know, we'll see.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been working on it for 5 or 6 years, but that's whenever I had a chance, when I wasn't at my day job or whatever else I was doing. So it's, you know, it wasn't 5 or 6 years of working on it full time.
Yeah. So
Monday through Friday.
When the COVID hit, did you got locked down and then did you get laid off or out of work?
No, I never lost any time at work.
Oh, so that didn't give you time to start working on the book, to hardcore work.
No, but it was during that I got a huge amount of it done, because also I stopped doing my podcast for a year and a half, and that helped too. So,
are you back doing the podcast again, or no, not yet?
Yeah, I'm doing it again. Yeah,
going to Rockin' Pod this year.
Maybe.
You don't have far to drive. You're in, like, where are you, in the Midwest, somewhere in Illinois?
Yeah, it's like a 9-hour drive. And every year I stop in St. Louis to go to record stores. There's great record stores in St. Louis, and make a whole trip of it.
How many Cheap Trick books are out now? So there's Robert Lawson's, which is like it goes album by album. And then there's the one that came out a long time ago that was out of print for a while. Are there other Cheap Trick books?
No, that's it. Yeah, Reputation is a Fragile Thing came out in 98. And then, you know, Doug Broad's book, They Just Seem a Little Weird, that came out, you know, last year, 2 years ago. Yeah, that's about Kiss.
Kiss, Cheap Trick Stars. Yeah. And yeah, I read that book. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you want to write a Cheap Trick book?
Well, yeah, you know, they're just my favorite band.
Are they?
Yeah, and it's something, I mean, I read every book about bands like this, and it's something I always wanted to do. Do you have any of those little 33 and a third books that are about specific albums? Do you know those?
I know of them. Does Martin Popoff do those books?
No, they're all different, about all different kinds of albums, but...
those are easier to do than this.
Yeah, that was my original idea, was to do a book, to pitch a 33 and a third book about the first Cheap Trick album.
Uh-huh.
But then once I got Ken Adamany involved and then Bunny Carlos, it just, you know, ballooned into something else.
I'm surprised Bunny agreed to get involved. How'd you approach him?
That was Ken Adamany who brought him in. One of the earliest people I talked to was a guy named Jim Charney, who worked for Epic at the time Cheap Trick were signed. And he actually went to school in Madison and knew Ken Adamany and was aware of Fuse and stuff back in the late 60s. And he's still friends with Ken Adamany to this day. So he offered to link me up with Ken, which is something I never even considered to be a possibility, really. Ken Adamany has always kind of been a mysterious figure. You know, he hasn't worked for the band since the 90s, and I don't think I ever even entertained the idea that I'd actually be able to talk to Ken, let alone develop a relationship with him, where he's really helped me a lot. And it took maybe a year that we were supposed to do this meeting, me and Ken, and when it finally happened, he brought Bunny into it, which was really interesting because Bunny's manager told me that Ken and Bunny had not been in the same room since the 90s.
So for people who don't know, tell people who Ken Adamany is.
Yeah, he managed Cheap Trick from the very beginning all the way up until like the mid-90s. And also he managed Fuse, you know, the band that Rick and Tom were in even before Cheap Trick. He was a big booking agent and promoter in the Midwest all through the 60s and 70s. So... you know, he managed some other bands, but really Cheap Trick was his main focus for a long time. And but he managed, you know, the band Off Broadway. He managed them, managed the Elvis Brothers. He even managed House of Lords at one point. One piece of paper Ken gave me at one point was printed on the back of an invoice for James Christian, who was the singer of House of Lords. Uh-huh. And I think it was like an invoice, and it was a royalty statement for like 27 cents.
Uh-huh. Sounds about right. House of
Yeah.
I think I might have gotten one or two of those in Exodus. So,
right.
Or is he on good terms with the rest of the guys in Cheap Trick? Because, you know, Bunny is, well, everybody knows the story about Bunny.
Yeah, apparently not.
Oh, really?
It's a sad situation with Ken and Bunny and the rest of the band.
I think those guys hold grudges or something. The guys in the band now, I think they hold grudges.
Yeah, I don't know what went down between them and Ken. I mean, their career really was in the toilet when they fired Ken. You know, they got dropped by Epic, then they had the whole debacle with Warner Brothers that apparently was really a disaster. When they had that deal with Warner Brothers, they had a lot of legal problems. It did not go well. And that's when they fired Ken, was after that. And then they did the 97 album, yeah. Which a lot of that album seems to be directed at Ken, like the anger of it.
Yeah.
But,
you know, I went to one of those shows in Vegas when they did, I went to the Special One show where the era of Special,
mm-hmm.
Well, they did the, it actually was that entire Red Ant era was the show I went to. Man, mm-hmm. Was that fucking good. God, it was fucking good.
Yeah. I saw them a lot at that time when that album came out, and they used to do, I actually found a tape of, I recorded a show in like 98, and I think they did 8 songs from that album. They were playing those songs a lot for a couple years there.
I saw them during that time when they did the 3 albums, you know, each
yeah.
consecutive night, and I went to all 3 nights, and they did a bunch of Red Ant mm-hmm. stuff during that time. When was the first
time? Yeah, that was 98, yeah.
When was the first time you ever saw Cheap Trick?
It was actually the Woke Up With a Monster
okay.
tour.
How old are you?
Yeah. I'm 48.
Oh,
so,
still,
yeah, it was.
Still a kid.
I was like 20 or something the first time I saw them.
Yeah, what about Ken Mills? Has he ever even seen Cheap Trick?
yeah, he definitely has. I don't know when's the last time. Yeah.
How's Ken Mills doing? Hey, Ken, if you're listening.
Ken is good. Ken's really not very interested in podcasting too much anymore.
Huh. The self-proclaimed podfather is no longer interested in podcasting. Isn't it? Isn't that interesting, huh? Well, sorry to see you go, Ken. You're welcome back anytime. So that means Cheap Trick, Cheap Talk Trick. What's it?
Cheap Talk with Trick Chat.
Yeah, the Cheap yeah. Talk podcast. That means it's dead.
Well, I'm. Hopefully, we're going to do an episode to promote the book, but it hasn't really happened. The last thing we did was when the new album came out. We did an episode for that.
Yeah, I remember that. Is the Facebook group still happening?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty active still, but it seems like maybe even the majority of the people on there don't even know it's a podcast. They just think it's a Cheap Trick page.
Yeah, probably. Do you know the girl who runs the Rick Nielsen Appreciation Society?
Lisa Jepsen. I mean, I don't really know her. I know who she is, yeah.
Yeah, I met her at the Vegas residency.
Oh, cool, yeah.
She seemed nice. She wouldn't come on the podcast, so I guess I'm stuck with dudes.
Right.
So I'm up to chapter 7. I should have finished the book, but if it was audiobook, I'd have been finished a long time ago. But I'm up to chapter 7. I'm enjoying it. It's getting more interesting as it goes. I mean, it is super. If you are a geek, man, this book goes deep, man. I mean, real deep. It's almost like an oral history. It's kind of written in an oral history. Did you think about writing it that way?
Yeah, that's kind of what I landed on. I was a mixture of oral history because I had so many interviews, and then, you know, I just had all these great quotes, and it seemed like just use these. So it's a mixture of that, of prose and oral history. So
the interviews, were they all written, or did you talk to people on the phone and stuff?
Yeah, it was almost all on the phone.
Yeah, you talked to Bunny on the phone.
Yeah, I talked to Bunny a lot. But Bunny, well, we had that meeting. That was face-to-face meeting at Ken Adamany's Country Club for like 3.5 hours. That was probably in 2018.
That is Country Club.
But then, Ken actually only lives like a half hour away from me.
Does Bunny play golf?
I don't think so.
So you guys
just where Ken.
You guys didn't play golf then. You just went to the bar.
No, we just. Yeah, they just have like a club there, you know. A bar restaurant that we had a room in, and that was like a 3.5-hour meeting. But after that, I didn't really talk to Bunny at all until I got the publisher on board. And then once I got the publisher on board, he tried to answer anything I asked him. Like every single question I asked him, he would try to answer.
Now you had credibility.
Yeah.
That first meeting when you met Bunny, were you a little bit nervous meeting Bunny?
Yeah, it was insane. I just sat next to him and he just talked to me a lot. I have a recording of it. I might put some of it on my podcast. I asked Bunny recently, I emailed him if it was okay if I ran some clips by him that I might use on the podcast, and he said to send him the clips. But
send him the clips, yeah, so he can approve them.
Yeah. Wow. I have this handwritten piece of paper where he wrote, he had all the years and who was in what band.
Well, you have those Bunny's bootlegs? You do, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's an archivist, another word you call it for a hoarder, I guess, but he's an archivist.
Yeah, one time he called me up and he said, I found these tapes, and he just read me the set list for some of the shows. Those are in the book, those set lists that he had.
Yeah, I haven't got that far yet. I haven't got to where Cheap Trick is formed yet. I'm only in the part where they're just starting to hook up with Xander. Lifetime Away From Home, Sick Man of Europe time. So Xander's not even in the band yet.
Right. Yeah, I think it was the Classic Rock Review that said, you know, it's 147 pages until you get the Robin joining the band.
Yeah. That's cool. You got Classic Rock.
Amazing. That's like a dream come true. There's so much that happens before Robin. There's plenty of Robin about Robin.
Yeah, other bands.
During those 147 pages, yeah.
So the first time, so what was the very first thing you said? I mean, I'm going to geek out Bunny a little bit, because if I met Bunny, I met Rick a couple of times, and I was a complete idiot. If I would have met Bunny, I would have probably been the same way. What was the first thing? I guess Ken said, hi, Bunny, this is Brian.
Yeah. Yeah, they were already there.
You showed up late?
No, but they got there early.
Oh, that's good.
And when I walked in the door of that building, straight in front of me was Bunny Garlos. And his manager was there too, Dave Fry. It was very surreal. It was crazy.
You didn't bring a bunch of albums and shit to sign, did you? Because I would.
I brought in Color and got him to sign the gatefold of that.
Now, did you pull that out at the beginning of the talk or after?
No, I pulled
it
out at the end.
Yeah.
I pulled it at the end, but I remember I didn't even have to say a word. He just immediately took it, signed it. I mean, it was like, obviously, he thought it a billion times, especially that gatefold. I mean, that's probably one of the main things people ask him to sign.
It's hard to be cool and businesslike when you're a super fan.
Yeah.
I would have been a super fan. I mean, the first time I met Rick Nielsen at Macworld once. I was at Macworld in San Francisco, and I said, Rick Nielsen. I said, hey, Rick Nielsen, I have a podcast. Would you do an ID for my podcast? And he held a microphone in front of his face. And I remember saying something about, I really like Special One. And I said, why did I say that, you fucking moron?
Well, I think I had already sent a list of topics, so Bunny kind of came prepared. He knew the kind of stuff I wanted to know about, and he just started talking and talked a lot, and you know, talked about, it was a lot of the history, because the whole history of what Rick Nielsen did before Cheap Trick is very convoluted. There were lots of different people in and out, and when did this happen, who was in the band at this time, what was the band called, there's all this stuff that I was trying to pin down, and it's really difficult to. But I think through the help of Bunny and especially a guy named Rick Pemberton, who played in a lot of that stuff, they really did help. And a few other guys, there's a guy named Ted Kenny, people who were there and remember it because it's more significant to them than maybe it was to Rick Nielsen, you know?
How'd you find those guys? You look them up on Facebook or something?
A lot of them I did. I remember, well, Rick Pemberton Bunny just gave me his phone number because Rick is one of his close friends. Rick Pemberton played, he played with Bunny's brother in a band. He played with Rick Nielsen and stuff. He was at the first ever Cheap Trick show. He kind of roadied for them for the, their very first gig. He was around for a lot of stuff. And then Ted Kenny, I found his son on Facebook, and his son linked me up with him. He was actually one of the very last guys I talked to. I really wanted to talk to him when I heard about this show that he put on. He, at some point, he ended up joining a version of Fuse as the drummer, but this was when Rick and Tom weren't in the band anymore. And so it was Craig Myers and Joe Sundberg who were the guitar player and the singer of Fuse, but at some point, they quit. But they still had some gigs on the books, and this guy, Ted Kenny, ended up doing the gigs with no original members of Fuse, and Bunny Carlos and Robin Zander performed as a part of that version of Fuse. So I really wanted to get that story because it was, you know, this kind of ridiculous thing where here you have Robin and Bunny playing in the band that was Rick and Tom's band, and Rick and Tom aren't there. So,
were there any Fuse or Grim Reaper's tunes that eventually made into a Cheap Trick song?
No. Yeah, there was a very different, you've probably heard that record. It's like, you don't really hear any Cheap Trick in that.
Yeah, Rick didn't I did not know until I read your book, Rick Nielsen didn't even play guitar. He was the keyboard player, right? Or was that the Grim Reapers?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah, no, that was Fuse. Because Craig Myers was like, everyone says he was a virtuoso. Uh-huh. You know, Rick would play some guitar live, like on certain songs, but on the album, Rick didn't play any guitar.
Rick probably knew everybody because I did not know. Also, I learned in your book that his dad owned a music store and Rick worked there. And so he had access to all this cool gear. So Rick probably knew everybody because they went to the only music store in town, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of a gathering place for all these guys. And that made Rick, you know, kind of one of the main guys in that whole scene. Yeah. And also that's part of his whole guitar collecting obsession is, he used his dad's store to get his hands on a lot of rare guitars. There's some funny stories in the book about that, too, about different guitars coming in and out of that store.
Did you approach anybody in Cheap, other any of the other guys in Cheap Trick, or was it, or was there something with Bunny that said, I'm not going to be in it if any of those guys talk?
No, I tried to talk to all of them. Even right before the book was going to be locked, I made one last attempt to get Rick to talk to me. And his management finally said, we considered your request and decline at this time because it will compete with our other projects or whatever. Supposedly there's a documentary in the works, I think, but they've had a couple different documentaries in the works that didn't pan out. But supposedly there's another documentary in the works now.
When he finally got back to you, had they just ignored you the rest of the time?
Pretty much. I had heard from his management few years ago when I first tried, but I wanted to make one last attempt, say the book is coming out, you can read the book if you want, I'll send it, whatever. And I don't know. Yeah, I just got to know.
You think those guys read these books?
I don't know. Paul Hamer, you know, of Hamer Guitars,
He's in the book. You talked to him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Joel Danzig, who, you know, was his partner in Hamer. Joel Danzig is the guy who really built all those guitars, like the 12-string bass and the five neck and all that kind of stuff. But Paul Hamer, I tried to get an advance copy of the book to the people that I talked to who helped me out. So I emailed Paul Hamer asking him if he wanted an advance copy, and he wrote me back. He said, I just talked to Rick, and he wants a copy. So I sent two copies to Paul, and he's supposedly going to give one to Rick next time he sees him. So we'll see. And I think the publisher is trying to send them to Robin and Tom. Bunny already has it. So
did you get any feedback from Bunny about the book?
Well, he gave me a blurb that's on the back.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't mean he read it.
Yeah, I had sent him an early, you know, like a PDF of it. So, but now he has the actual book.
Tom Werman did a blurb, too. Is he in the book?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He gave you a great blurb. That's like a raving. It says, Brian has meticulously researched the band's history and reveals fascinating things that even the most ardent Trick fan couldn't know without the colorful, fact-filled chronicle. This color, I can't read. It's a definitive history of a unique and brilliant group, the most talented, clever, entertaining band I experienced in 30 years as A&R man. That's a pretty good blurb. He's on the outs with Cheap Trick too, isn't he? Because I interviewed Tom Werman a long time ago.
Yeah, he's a super nice guy. They rewrite history about how they don't like In Color, which they weren't complaining about it at the time.
I think that's bullshit, man. That album's fucking great, and the original mix is way better than Steve Albini's mix. Sucks, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think it's an amazing album, but I don't know. I don't think they have an adversarial relationship with Tom. I think they've said negative things about Tom a lot in the press, and Tom is just kind of bummed out about it. But he doesn't have any bad feelings.
I wonder why
feelings.
Those guys are so... A long, long time ago, I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame... Or not Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Somehow I got in there as press. They don't do that anymore, but at the time I got in as press. And this was when Cheap Trick were there. They were doing, like, clinics. And I chose... Each guy was doing a clinic separately. Drums, et cetera, et cetera. And I went to Rick's, and I talked to Rick after... He was really cool, and I told him that I had a podcast, and he goes, I'll do your podcast. And right after that, I said it on my show, and a guy who did a podcast listened to my show and approached Rick Nielsen, and I think Rick Nielsen thought he was doing my podcast, and he did this guy's podcast. But other than that, those guys, I don't know why they're so... I don't want to say the word dickish, but they are kind of dickish to small-time press people.
Sometimes. It seems like they're very private, and I don't think they have a lot of interest in any of their private life or anything like that coming out, but I had zero interest in putting any of that in the book.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially during the pandemic, they seem to talk to anyone. I saw a guy on YouTube ask Robin Zander which came first, the Werman version of In Color or the Albini version of In Color.
That's the stupidest question of all time.
Yeah, he asked them that, and I'm sitting there watching it going, he talks to this guy and not me. This is fucking insane.
I ran into Robin at South by Southwest the day after Bunny quit the band. And they played with Dax. I mean, it was like, I don't know if it was the day after, but it was right around that time. And Rick was, Robin was really cool, took pictures and everything. And so I don't know, maybe their manager doesn't let him or something. I also heard that they were charging $5,000 to have a pod. I guess they got so many interview requests, they were charging $5,000 to do an interview. That's what maybe it'd been a rumor. I don't know.
I don't know if they have an attitude of, if you're writing a book, you're trying to make money off of them and they don't want to. Uh-huh. I don't know if there's anything like that, but I got to shake Robin's hand in the Wisconsin Dells when he did one of those solo shows with Brian Beebe a few years ago.
I went to
he
one just of came those. Out,
he just came out in the crowd, and he seems incredibly nice.
Yeah, they all seem to be nice. Every time I've talked to any of them, they seem to be nice. It's just, I don't know what it is. They still have the same manager they had back when they did Special One or after around that time? What's his name?
I don't think so. Well, their manager, they have this agency now. Kevin Spellman is the guy I've talked to. I think they have a couple different...
Oh, yeah, Kevin Spellman, he's the guy. Agency. He's a Sanford Bay Area guy, I think.
They were managed by... Right after Ken, they were managed by... What's his name? Larry... I'm blanking on his name, but Dave Fry, who manages
Dave
Bunny
Fry,
still, he managed them for a while.
Yeah, Dave Fry was with him when I met Rick at Macworld.
I think Dave Fry basically left with Bunny. Hmm. And he still manages Bunny.
Did you ask Bunny what the settlement was when he...
No.
That would have been that would have probably been something that would have probably been like, slowly I turned. You would have been hit, punched out.
I didn't have the nerve to ask Ken or Bunny anything about their situation with the band. Uh-huh. You know, like you read Tom Ruben say, my book's a definitive history. Of course, it only goes up to Budokan. The book doesn't like go any further than that. So it's not their whole career. I think my book is about the most interesting part, because once they become rock stars, it's like everybody knows that story.
Now, how far does your book go?
It basically goes up to when Budokan's about to come out in the U.S.
Okay, so they hadn't broke yet. It was right before they broke.
Yeah, that was kind of the idea of ended at the big cliffhanger where everybody knows what happens after that.
Right. Well, do you know anything about Rick not doing these latest shows? You know anything about that?
Yeah, he just came back. He was at the Atlantic City show.
He is back.
Yeah, he sprained his ankle really bad on stage, I guess, and that's, I think he was even in the hospital for that effort.
Maybe he's had
so
a
he
tough
just
time
had healing. To yeah, he just had to recuperate with his ankle so he could stand and move around on stage, I guess.
One time I saw him at a state fair about 3 years ago, and he looked like he had cancer. I thought he was going to die soon. I mean, he looked really bad. But then the last time I saw him, he looked really healthy, so.
He looks good. The last time I saw them was July 4th, you know, over a year ago, year and a month ago or whatever. And I one thing I noticed is when he came out with the five neck, he had to go lean on the drum riser. Like he couldn't really. He's having a hard time. Uh-huh. That thing must be pretty damn heavy. And it seems like he's getting a little old to be going crazy with that five neck. But he's looking good, though.
Guy who lives down the street from me up here in the mountains. Well, he's got a place up in the mountains, but he's also a world-famous guitar guy in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Jet Boy, I may have already told you this, I don't know. When I was in Jet Boy, Uncle Dick was in his shop, and Fernie worked.
Right.
Fernie from Jet Boy worked in the shop, and I don't know, maybe I'll get in trouble by saying this, but I went to the shop and held Uncle Dick. Man,
right.
It was so fucking cool.
I know. Yeah, it's amazing. I got to see it at Rick's Picks. It was in a glass case, but it was right there. You could walk right up to it.
He must have a couple of Uncle Dicks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely has more than one. I don't know what happened, you know, when that stage collapse happened, and I think most of whatever he had on stage got wrecked.
I didn't know that. Did you see him on the American Pickers or whatever that show's called?
Yeah. Yeah, that drove me nuts.
He sold those things for like almost nothing. You think that's true?
I guess.
Yeah,
I
ain't buying it.
He had the still sealed versions of the solo albums with a letter from Gene Simmons, and he sold that to the guy for like $200 for all four sealed solo albums with a letter from Gene Simmons.
all four Kiss solo albums.
Yeah. Still sealed.
Huh, yeah.
So they've got the posters and the merch catalogs and everything that were in there.
Right.
And then there was an actual handwritten note from Gene Simmons, like signed and everything. So that's, I think it was $200. Yeah, that episode drove me nuts. Because the one guy kept talking about what a huge Cheap Trick fan he was, and you could tell that he knows Surrender and Dream Police. That's what a huge fan.
I saw him on Rachel Ray. Rachel Ray had a show on, I don't remember what, she had some sort of talk show or something before she had this daytime show, and she had Rick Nielsen on when he was making pizza at a pizza place. Mm-hmm. And she acted like she was a big, huge Cheap Trick fan too, and she didn't even say the titles of the song right. But although I'll give Rachel Ray a pass because I have a secret crush on Rachel Ray. But even when she's fat, I still have a crush on her. So what else was involved in the research? I envisioned that you went to the library and got microfilm, and that, but I know you didn't. But
no, there's a few different newspaper databases online that you can search, and you have to subscribe to them and stuff. But I did a lot with that. I did a lot of old magazines. I bought a lot of old magazines. I already had.
Which old magazines? Cream and what else? You quoted Trouser Press. I saw some quotes from.
Yeah, there's a bunch of old stuff I got. I mean, I got an old zine from Michigan where they were interviewed. The one guitar player that Rick was on the cover of, that's a really great article. And that, you know, just everything from that time period that I could find, a lot of stuff on eBay, I would just buy it. Also, there's a guy, he has a website called the 12 String Bass Encyclopedia. That guy sent me a whole bunch of great articles that he has. It was just kind of, you know, all kinds of different sources. There's hundreds of sources, you know, because even though I didn't talk to Rick, Robin, and Tom, there's tons of quotes from them in the book that I gathered from hundreds of sources.
I guess that's legal to do. You didn't have to. Did you have to credit the source? Because a lot of these shows.
Yeah, they're all credited at the end. You know, I watched any YouTube video, any podcast they were on. There's a lot of quotes in the book. There's a bunch of quotes in the book from YouTube videos, even from the last couple of years. Uh-huh. There's been some great interviews, like that one that's on the Gibson YouTube channel. Got some great stuff from that. It was Rick talking about guitars. Also, there's that book that came out a few years ago called, it's called Cheap Licks. And it's like Rick, the book is all, I think it's all just music notation and, you know, Rick telling you how to play different riffs. But if you buy the book, you got a code for these videos. And there's Rick's telling a bunch of stories in those videos.
So in those things, you think Rick gets a kickback from those?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that his name's on that book.
Oh, okay, okay.
He Cheap did Licks. Okay. Cheap Licks, it's called. You know, I didn't know what the book was, so I ordered it, and it turns out it's just music, but it came with those videos. It came with codes for those videos. Ended up being some really good stuff.
Did you try to talk to Rick and Robin's kids at all?
No. One guy I know is friends with Dax, and at one point he tried to help me get Rick to talk to me by going through Dax, but Dax was just like, my dad's not going to do anything because I ask him to do it.
Right. Yeah. So, are you married?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You are. What's your wife think about you spending all your time obsessing on Cheap Trick? Because, I mean, the chances of making a lot of money on a book, everybody knows books don't really pay that well, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to quit my day job. I'm sure she's sick of hearing about Cheap Trick. I mean, that's when, you know, I mean, the book is for those people, but I don't have a lot of people in my life who care as much about Cheap Trick as I do.
What's your wife think of it? Is she a fan?
Yeah, she likes them, but,
did she get, you know, she, I mean, is she okay with you spending so many years writing a book about Cheap Trick?
Yeah, it was... We actually, right now, we work opposite schedules because I work third shift. So a lot of the time I was working out, she was at work.
Secret to a happy marriage, never see your wife. How long you been married?
22 years. Got married in 2000.
When you went to Rockin' Pod, you didn't bring your wife, right?
No.
Okay.
No, she wouldn't want to come to that.
Yeah. She's not into this. Does she like your podcast?
I don't know if she's ever listened to it.
Yeah, same with my wife. I'd rather my wife not listen to my podcast.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's probably embarrassing because it's so nerdy and, you know, mine.
So you're obviously an authority on Cheap Trick. I don't know anybody that knows more about Cheap Trick than you. You're like the go-to guy for all the Cheap Trick knowledge. But you also have a lot of knowledge on power pop and what other knowledge do you have? Because we can go over power pop bands and you would just leave me in the dust.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with glam rock, like Slade, T-Rex, Sweet, all that stuff. Punk rock, you know, from the Dead Boys to all kind, you know, obscure stuff. I love heavy metal.
Oh, really? Like the, like what kind of heavy metal? Like the thrash metal?
Nah, thrash metal's not really my... Yeah. I like poppier metal.
Right, yeah.
You know, but late 70s, 80s heavy metal is one of my favorite things. But I love plenty of hair metal, too. Uh-huh. I'm have a ridiculous amount of knowledge about all of that kind of stuff. I like a lot of 90s indie rock, too.
In the book, there's also, for people who don't know, there's also a ton of photographs in here as well. Did the people in the book give you all these photographs, or how did you find these pictures? Because you got to get rights to post photos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some of the really cool stuff's from Ken Adamany, and Bunny gave me some pictures. A lot of great pictures in there are from Rich Kwasniewski, who took a lot of pictures of the band. All those, he took, you know, that famous picture of Rick with the accordion. Rich Kwasniewski took that, and there's a whole bunch of pictures from that session in there, which was at Rick's dad's store in early 76. Those are amazing pictures from that. I got the publisher to just fill those pages with them because there were so many of them and they're so cool.
Now, did they give you these photos, or did you have to give them, you have to pay for the, you know, you have to give them a cut of the book, or
nope.
what?
No, Rich Kwasniewski has been insanely generous, just letting me use whatever I wanted.
Yeah,
amazing guy. There's a couple fans who had like posted stuff on Facebook that let me. A few of those pictures are things I saw on Facebook originally. The photo that I asked people for permission.
The accordion was 1976. That's first album, right?
Yeah, it's before the it's before they even record, before they even got a record deal. Those pictures were taken. The one, you know, the picture of Rick with the accordion is kind of a famous picture. There's the one picture they used for promo, and Rick's actually holding it on the first album cover. And it came from that. Okay. It came from that session there. There's a whole bunch of pictures in the book of Rick with the accordion, though. And then from that same session, there's pictures of the other guys, too. They're really great.
Well, man, I got to say, you did really... You set the bar high on geek out books on bands. Other than Trouble Boys, this is the most hardcore, in-depth book I've read.
Yeah, in one respect, I ripped off Greg Renoff because Van Halen Rising is a similar concept of just telling the early story of the band.
Right.
And you know, I've known Greg a long time. He came on my podcast even before he'd finished writing the book.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Yeah,
He was an inspiration. One important thing is I have so many dates of where and when they played, because they just played constantly through those years, you know, 74 to 77, just all the club shows. So I turned it into a kind of a chronological book, almost a day by day. And so anytime I would get a new piece of information, I knew right where to put it.
Right.
Because it's mostly all chronological. So once it got to the point where I'm just sliding this piece here, this piece here, it just kept building and building. And so I was like, anything I find out, I got to put in the book. So it's a lot of crazy, you know, specific information and stories.
Did the publisher make you edit anything out of it?
No. I was amazed because... I think my contract said the book was supposed to be 90,000 words, and I sent them like 130,000 words, and they didn't ask me to cut anything. This is like a long book for them to publish, but I was sitting there like, how am I going to cut this down to 90,000 words? And I said, fuck it, I'm just going to send it, see what happens. And then they never even asked me to cut anything. So,
well, that's good.
And
you use the Cheap Trick font. I guess they don't own the copyright to that font, I guess. It's just a typewriter font.
Yeah, and that's how I came up with the subtitle, which is How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick. I always envisioned it on the book so it would kind of approximate the logo.
Yeah, Rick will love that. if only he would have copywritten the placement of that logo like that.
Well, I talked to the guy who designed the logo, and he never made 1 cent off that logo. Because he was a huge fan. That's one of the best stories in the book, probably, is the telling of the creating of the logo. And he made that logo because he loved the band so much and just wanted to do something. His dad had a graphic design studio. His dad did that for a living, and he worked with his dad, and he just did it. The band didn't even know he was doing it, and he just went and handed it to him. And it's got to be like the best logo ever.
It's one of them. It's iconic, and Cheap Trick doesn't pay him one dime probably for all those T-shirts.
He didn't want anything. He just gave it to him. This was in 1970. Actually, I think it was even in 74. There's one poster I saw that had a copyright in 1974 after the logo. Uh-huh. I always thought he had done the logo in 75, but it looks like it might even have been in 74. That he made that logo, so it goes way back. They had it for years before they even had a record.
And is that guy still alive?
Yeah, he's great. Chris Crow is his name. He went on to work in Hollywood. He directed movies. He made TV shows. People might remember Cheap Trick around that weird TV show in the 90s. Now I'm not remembering the name of it. It was The Something. They had this like cameo on this weird TV show that lasts like one season, but Chris Crow actually created that show.
Did you talk to him in the book?
Yeah, yeah, he was great. Because he's a writer, he wrote for movies and TV, and so he was really articulate about talking about how much he loved the band in the early years and why he liked them so much and why he wanted to create that logo for them. So it's a really great part of the book, I think.
I'm sorry I didn't finish it before I talked to you. I was continuing it this morning. I was up in a tree stand at 5:30 this morning, and I've stuck the book down my pants so I could climb up the tree stand. And I started to open the book, and just as I opened the book, I pulled the book out of my pants, and two deer came right under the tree stand, followed by a 300-pound bear.
Sounds like the book is good luck.
Well,
you should take the book
because
with you hunting all the time.
I missed the deer. I missed the fucking deer.
I jinxed you.
Well, what happened was I pulled, this is not related to the book, but what happened was I was pulling the bow up on, I was bow hunting. I was pulling the bow up on a string, and it was 5:30. I was half asleep, and I didn't tie it very well, and I got the bow almost all the way up to the tree stand, and the bow fell. The string came untied, and the bow fell onto the ground. I had to climb down, and it knocked the sight out. So when I took a shot at the deer, it went like a foot underneath the deer. So I'm sure the deer's happy, but I'll give it a try tonight. I'm going to bring your book up with me again tonight. So maybe the book cool. brought the deer in. So I'm going to say the book brought the deer in, and the book didn't make me drop the bow. So I'm going to bring it with me tonight.
Right.
Well, BJ, thank you for doing this, and congratulations on the book. Everybody, it's a really good read, and I can't wait to get to it. I mean, it's interesting. Even the early stuff, it's going to get more interesting, I have a feeling, too. So I know a lot of people are looking forward to getting it. So if you buy the book, friends, tell them you bought it because you heard it on the Rock and Roll Geek Show, please. So BJ doesn't think... He doesn't continue holding the grudge. Are you still talking to Bunny and Ken?
Yeah, I just emailed Bunny, this weekend asking him about using those clips on the show. Yeah, Ken Adamant, he loves the book. He's so excited about it. Good. So that's been great. The book, I tried to pin down all those elusive. I mean, I don't know how many people are interested, but anybody who's a huge fan of Cheap Trick, all these kind of obscure stories about how the hell the band formed and what they were doing and what were all these other bands they were in. And I just tried to pin all of that down as much as I could. So it was a big goal.
Anything you learn making this book that really, surprised you?
About Cheap Trick?
Yeah,
or
about anything making the book. Not learned about writing. I mean, learned about the band and history, whatever.
Yeah, I guess there's not like a lot of bombshells that I had no inkling of before. There's just a lot of things where you kind of have heard this, but you're not sure what actually happened, and just trying to figure out what actually happened and what the actual timeline was. But there's really great little stories like the story that Bunny told me about how Patti Smith tore up their picture at the record plant because she was pissed off at Jack Douglas, and she ripped the picture of Cheap Trick off the wall and just tore it up. That's
jealous.
Yeah, all the little, I have that list of people in the summary of the book that show up in the book. Like, they did a show in Buffalo, New York that was promoted by Harvey Weinstein, or like Ken Adamany when he was in college. He was in a band with Boz Scaggs and Steve Miller, and one of their friends was Michael Mann, the filmmaker, the guy who created Miami Vice. All these different characters, all these different people show up. Like, the band that they opened for at the Starwood in 75 was called Bandit, and the guy who sang for that band, his name was Timothy. I can't remember his last name, but he told me that guy who was the singer before him was Don Johnson. Huh. Like, you hear these crazy names come up over the course of the story that are just, you can't believe now this guy's turning up in this story. So, Don Johnson.
So does Bunny have like a photographic memory?
I wouldn't say that. I've definitely, figured out things Bunny is wrong about remembering wrong.
Okay.
For example, in Mike Hayes's book from 1998, it says the very first show with Robin Zander was a junior prom at Pewaukee High School. And I knew that show happened in October, so it couldn't have been a prom.
Uh-huh, right.
And I ended up finding the newspaper article. It was actually the homecoming. I found the actual newspaper article about the Pewaukee homecoming on that exact date.
Right.
That they played. So he has said for years it was a junior prom. It was actually homecoming. That's like not a big deal, but it's just, you know, little details like that that I've tried to make sure I have correct.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Did you impress Bunny at all with your extreme knowledge?
I don't know. It might be more like, you know, made him wary of me.
Oh, yeah. Cause what's this guy obsessing on Cheap Trick? Yeah. They probably, yeah. The Cheap Trick fans, I mean, there's some hardcore fans who are super knowledgeable. I mean, I'm embarrassed that they're my favorite band, and I don't know as much, that I know so little about Cheap Trick. I'm embarrassed that I know so little, as much of a fan as I am. So, but there's some people who are really, really, it's like Star Trek and Star Wars.
I think it's really interesting because those four guys, obviously it was magic, and it took a long time and a lot of trial and error before Rick Nielsen ended up with that band with those guys, and that's what worked for him. And when you see how many different permutations of bands Rick Nielsen tried before he ended up there, it's, you know, it's fascinating. And then that's the magic of a band, is it's those four guys have that chemistry, and those combination of that, those four talents is what made for this amazing band. But Rick Nielsen played with so many other people trying to get to that band, and then he finally got there, you know.
And all those bands are different different styles of music than Cheap Trick.
Yeah, that's another crazy thing, is I still can't figure out where Rick Nielsen's songwriting style came from, because all of a sudden, like 1975, he starts writing these insane songs. I mean, you know what his influences were, like Alex Harvey Band and Sparks and all these different, he had a lot of different kinds of influences, but he obviously created his own thing, and it's pretty insane. The songs he wrote, he wasn't trying to write anything commercial. He wasn't even trying to write anything it seemed like anyone else would like.
Yeah.
And a lot of, that's a reason a lot of people liked it. I mean, it was punk before punk. It was metal before metal. It was crazy, the kind of songs he was writing at that time, like in 1975, when he was writing shit like He's a Whore and Ballad of TV Violence and these Ballad of Richard Speck. Those songs at that time are crazy. And why that's what he was writing, that's the main thing I wish I could talk to Rick Nielsen about, is songwriting and how it developed and how he landed on that style. And I think one thing that I talk about in the book is that his approach to guitar was different. Like Craig Myers, who I talk about, who was the guitar player in Fuse, he was one of those guys who loved Eric Clapton, just play blues licks and just solo constantly. And Rick Nielsen used the guitar in a completely different way.
Yeah,
it's
like he wasn't, it's almost like he didn't study anybody's guitar playing styles.
He figured out, I don't know, he created his own style of songwriting through the guitar, and also used Robin Zander. Once he figured out that Robin Zander could sing everything, then he used that to its fullest potential. And that's why those early, especially the early Cheap Trick songs, the early albums are just my favorite thing ever, because it's like I say in my introduction, it's like everything else. It's what do I say? I wish I had the book.
Sounds like a lot of bands, but it also has its own.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like everything, but that's what makes it different, because there's elements of so many different things kind of, but at the same time, it's Rick's own, really his own creation that, like I said, I wish I could pick his brain about what his approach was, because it was really different, and it seemed purposeful, but at the same time, it also seems like, like I say, he's reckless and fearless in the way he does it. He doesn't care if it's a mess, and he doesn't care if anybody might even like it. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, it seems like, but it also came out at a time. I mean, they broke at a time when characters were kind of, you know, Kiss was happening, you know, Angus the Schoolboy was happening, Ted Nugent was happening. There were characters, and so the timing was really good. I wonder if he didn't have that look, because the songs are just greatest songs ever. I wonder if he didn't have that look, if they would have broke like they did.
Well, they were really uniquely set up for when New Wave hit. They could kind of ride that wave, even though they came out of 70s rock.
Yeah.
They weren't stuck in the 70s rock thing with like Kiss and whatever. They could ride the wave into like New Wave. And that's another thing I talk about, is how everybody loved them from Trouser Press to Bob Records. Stiff Records wanted to put out the first album in the UK because Epic didn't put it out. So they had fans like that, like Stiff Records loved them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they could go open for Kiss, and all the Kiss fans would love them.
Yep.
There wasn't really another band that had that kind of crossover where they could impress Stiff and Kiss fans.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I saw them open, the first time I saw them was open for Foreigner, so.
Yeah, they opened for a lot of crazy bands at that time, too, like Kansas, and they even opened for, like, Santana and stuff. They put them on crazy bills that make very little sense. Like, when they went over to the Europe to tour with Kansas right before they went to Japan, they were touring Europe with Kansas. But then they go to the Roundhouse and play a punk show with two punk bands while they're on tour with Kansas.
Yeah, that's great.
No, what other band could do that?
Yeah.
Nobody.
So what's the, you got any ideas for the next book, or are you planning on doing another book?
Yeah, I actually, I started research for a Dictators book, and the guys are on board.
All the guys, including Handsome Dick, right? Because you know Handsome Dick's a good friend of mine, right?
Yeah. I've gone back and forth with Handsome Dick, and I'm not sure. There's a lot of bad blood there.
Uh-huh. Why? Is there something with Andy? Is something with Andy says, I'm not going to give you any info if you have Handsome Dick?
No. Andy said he doesn't care at all. Handsome Dick, I think he's going to talk to me.
Trust me, he'll talk to you. Tell him you're friends. Tell him you're friends with me. You're in.
I've gone back and forth with him a lot on Messenger. I probably started too early because I've had too much to do with promoting the book to really get into it. But my idea is the book would be from the Dictators to Manowar, and Ross the Boss is down with that, with talk about Manowar too.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of but that's going to sell even less copies than the Cheap Trick book. So
do you expect to make money from the Cheap Trick book?
I mean, I'll make a little bit, but if you work out how many hours I spent on it, I'm definitely making way under minimum wage.
Oh, of course. You didn't get an advance, I'm assuming, right? They're just putting it.
Yeah, I got an advance, but it was in four small payments. So it was, and I haven't even gotten a fourth payment yet. So it's not like
small payments, like in the hundreds of dollars or thousands of
hundreds. Yeah,
okay, all right.
It didn't amount to much.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll take whatever I can get, but. We'll see what happens.
What's the deal like on the book, if you're allowed to say, or if you feel like saying it?
Yeah, you know, it's a small percentage, and then it's a percentage of the wholesale, not the cover price.
They give you a bunch of boxes that you can sell at shows and stuff?
They gave me 10 copies of the book.
10 copies, so you can't sell signed copies on your website.
Yeah, and people are asking for that. I can buy the books at wholesale. So, like, I could buy them for basically half price and then sell them at full price. But.
Okay, well, yeah, that may be something you have to do. But did you think about self-publishing it?
Yeah, I definitely did. It was definitely really kind of a dilemma because I could make a lot more money probably self-publishing it. Well, I mean, it all depends on how many I would sell. I would definitely make a lot more per book that was sold. But I want to get my foot in the door, because I want to do more.
The advantage of having a publisher is they're going to get it out there to get reviewed, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, and also, I have to say, once I got a publisher, I got a lot more information from Bunny and Ken Adamany that I didn't have before.
Yeah.
That's one funny thing is, it's so much better after I already had a contract with a publisher.
Did you have
the book?
Now, did you have to show the contract to them to prove that you had a publisher? Because you could have bullshitted your way and said you had a publisher.
No. But, yeah, I mean, everything worked out great. I was, there were times where I was pretty worried that it was going to get fucked up by Ken or Bunny. We're going to all of a sudden decide they weren't on board anymore. Who knows? I had a lot of paranoia, but everything worked out great. And they're very happy with, and like I said, having a publisher hopefully is just going to lead to more.
Yeah.
Whereas if I self-publish it, I would have no, that wouldn't lead to any credibility or any kind of a resume. So I figured a publisher is the best way to go because I definitely would like to do more.
So how did the publisher, I'm assuming the publisher sent me the book. You didn't send me one of your 10 copies, right?
Yeah, no, the publisher sent a lot of advanced copies out.
That's good.
Yeah.
Even to podcasters. Did you have to send them a list of people to send it to, or?
Yeah, I did. I sent them a list, and they sent them to everybody I asked them to. I tried not to go overboard.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's already been reviewed by Record Collector and Classic Rock. I don't think those issues are really out yet except for subscribers, but it's getting, there's Shindig Magazine is publishing an excerpt. Rock Candy Magazine, I think, is publishing an excerpt. you know, they sent it to like Eddie Trunk and people, and hopefully
that was my question. Was you did you?
Yeah, yeah, they sent it to him. You know, we'll see. I even got them to send it to Howard Stern,
right?
Because he's a big good. He talks about Cheap Trick.
Yeah,
I figure, you know, I could see within the realm of possibility that Howard Stern grabs this book and looks at it, and then even mentions it on his show. I don't think it's
a possibility. Outside the realm of possibility. You never know. Have you? Yeah. Are you allowed to send PDFs out to people so they can put it on their Kindle and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I sent some people PDFs that I was going to do interviews with and stuff. There's going to be a Kindle version, I'm sure, on Amazon probably. I guess, there is going to.
I mean, I hope this is not presumptuous of me, but could you send me the PDF so I can put it on my Kindle so I can bring it on the plane?
Yeah. Sure.
I'm heading to Florida in a week, and that it would be great to read it so I don't have to bring the book.
Yeah, actually, the PDF I have, there's two pages that aren't the same. I actually got them to change two pages when it was already sent to the printer. Because, you know, Marshall Mintz, he's the guy that Old Candy is about, the photographer.
Right,
Actually, after the book was already supposed to be locked, I got in touch with his daughter finally, which I've been trying forever, and just by chance. And she gave me some good information, just some good quotes about her dad. So I managed to get that in the book.
Well, that's good.
She also recently sent me an amazing picture, insane picture that her dad took, color. Because all the pictures you see that her dad took are black and white.
Uh-huh.
This one is color. So she let me... I asked if I could use it for an ad on the day the book comes out, and the publisher gave me a little bit of money. I'm going to blast Facebook with this with this picture.
Oh, that's good. What's the
try
picture?
To get some.
What is the picture
it's
of?
It's a picture of the band that her dad took in, like, 75. People will... You would know the Marshall Mintz pictures if you saw them. Tom has, like, a scarf wrapped around his head.
Uh-huh.
There's some... Robin has his hair pulled back in some, and he's got real long hair. Rick's not wearing a hat. Bunny is in character, though, by that time.
Right.
You would know these pictures if you saw them that her dad took. And this is from that time, but I've never seen a picture that her dad took that wasn't black and white. So you could see people will know those outfits they're wearing, but you can see what colors they were.
Huh, right.
And plus the pose that they're in is pretty. I mean, my mind was blown when she sent me that picture.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
I've found that's a way I've got, because I have some other pictures I've been releasing.
So that picture's not in the book, or is it?
No, she sent it to me way too late.
Okay.
I swear, I would have tried to get this picture to be the cover of the book if I would have had it.
Yeah.
She told me that she was told not to give out her dad's pictures, but she sent me this picture, and then I downloaded it, and then she deleted it. She, you know, was in Messenger, and she deleted it, but I had already downloaded it.
Oh, good.
So I put together this advertisement, and then I sent it to her, and I said, will you please let me use this? And she said, all right, you can use it.
Huh.
So I'm very lucky to have it, but I have a blog that I've been releasing some stuff that I have from Ken and Rich Krasnewski, and people get pretty excited about some of those pictures. I put out a picture that, it's all the guys from Cheap Trick sitting in an audience at a theater, Rich Kwasniewski doesn't even know where it was, but they're sitting there in the crowd, and it's all four guys, and it's a really cool picture, and people flipped out when I put that out. And I just released Ken Adame let me scan this thing he still has. It's a questionnaire that Rick Nielsen filled out in 1967. It's the he let me bring the actual paper home that Rick wrote on with a pen in 1967. He let me bring it home and scan it, and he let me put that out. I just put that out.
What's the blog called? Page.
It's this band. If you go to thisbandhasnopast.com, it takes you to the blog.
Okay. All right. I'll post a link to that when I do the show notes.
Yeah, I've been putting some cool stuff out on there, and I'm going to, in the next couple weeks, I'm going to put out more cool stuff. And then on the day of the book comes out, I'm going to put out that picture and just try to get... I found that's a really good way to get people's attention. It's like a cool picture they've never seen.
Yeah.
So
when's the release date on the book?
It's September 6th, Tuesday.
Coming up. What went through when the book arrived, the printed copy of the book, you held the first one in your hand. What was the first thing you did? Smell the book? Or did you run to the wife and say, "They're here, honey"?
Yeah, they sent me a box of six of them at first, and you know, it was a really surreal moment. It was kind of like, you're like, I'm not feeling as much as I thought I would be feeling in this moment, but it's been such a long process to get here that it's like, if I could go back and show myself 20 years ago, this book, I would fucking, you know, faint. I would, I would be so, but since I've gone through the entire process to get here, a lot of that, you know, is kind of gone. It's just been a long process to get here. I mean, you know, Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam wrote a foreword for me.
That's good.
I mean, I'm sure you're probably not a Pearl Jam fan, but like,
it's still cool to get him to write a foreword.
Yeah, when I got an email that he was going to write my foreword,
who told,
that was just
now, who made that happen? The publisher? Or
I did.
Oh, oh, you approached the guy.
Yeah, what happened was the publisher said, "We got to get somebody to write a foreword. Do you have any ideas for who could write a foreword?" And I was kind of thinking, who the hell could do this? And one idea I had was Cameron Crowe, you know, because Fast Times at Ridgemont High, he wrote that.
Right.
And I thought that was just one idea I had. And my friend Eric had an email for Cameron's production partner. I emailed him and asked, and he said, Cameron said he doesn't really have time right now, but you should ask Jeff. So then my friend also had, my friend Eric, who used to do a podcast, he had a contact for like a Pearl Jam person, I think her name's Sarah, emailed her, said, and I was able to say, Cameron Crowe said, you know, Jeff might be interested. Yeah. And then she said, I'll put it on Jeff's list of possible things to do. And then like, then they asked to see the book. So I sent a PDF of the book. And then it was like 2 months. I had just given up. I had figured it wasn't going to happen. And all of a sudden I get an email, just so you know, Jeff is interested in doing this, and he started working on it, and I just couldn't believe it, because, you know, that's a pretty big name to have on there. So, yeah. I mean, I had never even really thought about a foreword until the publisher wanted one, but, you know, I think that's a great thing to have somebody like that, because it's a from a different era, from a different... It just shows how much
shows
appeal
the influence.
Has.
Shows
yeah,
the influence.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah. You could have got the guy from Smashing Pumpkins. That would have been a pretty obvious choice.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends said that, and I said, yeah, but then the whole four would just be about Billy Corgan.
Right, yeah, about how he was influenced by.
I mean, of course, the name the publisher said was Dave Grohl. They're like, I mean, like someone like Dave Grohl, I'd be like, yeah, but it's not going to fucking be Dave Grohl if I have anything to do with it.
Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, BJ, thank you for doing this, and congratulations on the book. It's really quite the achievement. I mean, I got to say, I am quite impressed. You have surpassed all of us lame ass podcasters with this book, Frank.
Thank you. Yeah, it definitely was a labor of love, and you know, it's very nerdy and very
detailed. That's what you want, though.
But yeah, that's the only thing, the only kind of cheap trick book I was gonna write.
You're gonna you will do away with the casual cheap trick fans. And go straight to the hardcore fans. Maybe the casual Cheap Trick fans will come after the book is a hit. Are you going to do an audio book?
I do have the rights to that, but and I don't really know how that works. I was just talking about that yesterday.
Man, that would be an undertaking.
I think I could. I don't know what the process is to get it on Audible, but I think I maybe could. I don't know. The effort that I've put in, I'm sure wouldn't be worth the whatever pittance I would make off of it.
Yeah,
probably.
At this point, you're not doing it for the money. You can't be doing it for the money.
But I think that the book is really entertaining and really funny, and it's also, even if you're not a big Cheap Trick fan, it's the story of four guys devoting their lives to something, how hard they worked, and how how they didn't even try necessarily to be a commercial mainstream thing, and yet they still managed to do it, like I say, on their own terms, get a record deal, become successful, become a band that still to this day has staying power, people will go see. And, you know, you go see them, and Robin Zander is screaming suicide at the top of his lungs.
Yeah,
and it's just,
yeah, it's awesome. It's the greatest band ever.
Yeah.
All right. Any plans to see Cheap Trick again soon?
Whenever I can. The last time I saw them was that July 4th, a year ago.
How many times have you seen Cheap Trick?
I don't know the exact number, but it's somewhere between 40 and 50, probably. I have a bunch of ticket stubs, but I've seen them so many times where there wasn't a ticket stub.
I have zero ticket stubs. I must have seen them 150 times.
Yeah. It's, I've seen them plenty, but yeah. I saw those three album shows in New York, and they did that. I was at the Silver concert, the 25th anniversary.
Oh, wow, that's great. All right, BJ. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on. Tell people the name of the podcast and the website and all that stuff before we get out. And I will also put these links on the show notes at rockandrollgeek.com.
Yeah, Rock and Roll. I got a threatening letter from the Recording Industry Association of America or whatever. And I stopped doing the podcast for a while, but I brought it back with a bunch of power pop interviews. You mentioned power pop earlier. I've been releasing a lot of interviews I did with different guys from power pop bands. This week's episode about 2020, where I talked to Steve Allen and Ron Flint in 2020. So that's what I've had come out recently. It's a lot of power pop stuff.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but you got a cease and desist for playing music on your podcast?
Yeah.
What was the band?
There wasn't anything specific. They said to delete all copyrighted material, which is my entire podcast. So
did you delete all copyrighted material?
I just unpublished all my episodes, but it turns out because I had those players.
I would have ignored them.
Well, yeah.
It's funny that I have not gotten one. I better knock on wood.
Yeah. I think
if they send me a letter like that, I would just ignore them, and then they send me again, I'm going to say, leave me alone, or I'm going to sue you. I'd say something stupid like that.
Well,
what are they
going to
do? You got no money.
I was going through that time where I was trying to do the book and the weekly podcast, and I really was probably looking for an excuse to stop doing the podcast anyways. So when that happened, I just stopped doing it for a year and a half, and that's really when I finished the book. But, you know, I joined the Pantheon Network.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually making a little bit of money now off the podcast.
They're
the
Bay Area. They're from the Bay Area, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I still am not entirely sure what I'm doing with the podcast, because all these interviews I've been publishing, I did like a year or 2 years ago. I was doing them. I've had all these interviews. I've been sitting on them for a long time, most of them.
Pantheon, you gotta do ads, right? Or host it. Ads.
Yeah, I don't have anything to do with it, but there are ads on it.
They
handle all of that.
So you don't have to do, hey, everybody, go. You don't have to.
No,
tell them.
I don't have to read anything. I post my episodes, and then when it comes out, there's some ads on there. But it's just that all goes through Pantheon. I don't have to do anything with it.
Pantheon host your files?
They host it. And
that means if something happens, your podcast gets lost.
They're trying to. Yeah, that's a good point. I actually hadn't thought about that. Pantheon are trying to make things happen. They're trying to make things happen with music rights.
I know
they're they have this new thing they're doing. They've got this with a promoter where they're trying to help promote concerts, get the podcasts. I like that they're trying to make stuff happen.
What they're trying to do is get purchased by Spotify or somebody like that. That's maybe what they're trying to do.
I got kicked off Spotify.
I never even bothered because I knew what their deal was. I have no interest in being on Spotify or Pandora or any. I have no interest in even growing my audience. How do you like that?
Yeah, I just do what I do. There's only a limited number of people who are ever going to be interested in it. So I 100% don't know why I do the podcast anymore necessarily.
Maybe it's always fun.
Yeah, that's true, but they got ruined.
What'd they do? Send you a letter, an official letter, a letterhead in the mail?
Yeah. And they sent it to...
Yeah, go ahead.
They sent it to Podbean, so Podbean was going to shut me down anyways.
So you got it through Podbean.
Yeah.
Oh, no wonder. Lesson one, don't host your podcast on anything called Podbean.
Well, it was the cheapest, easiest one.
Yeah. Well,
where do you host your?
Well, I post them on Libsyn. I have files. You know, I keep all my files anyway. But Libsyn hosted them. If Libsyn sends me a letter, I'll just leave Libsyn. I don't give a shit. I ain't gonna delete all my podcasts. They can kiss my fucking ass. I'll go down flaming.
I definitely don't want to get sued. But like I said, I was probably looking for an excuse to stop doing the podcast anyways, and that was a good excuse.
I think the standard response would be, hey, dude, I'm broke. Come and get me.
Yeah.
All right, BJ. Well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you. And
Thanks for having me.
Maybe Michael. I'll see you at the next Rockin' Pod. We'll see.
I mean, you know this, but I've been listening to Rock and Roll Geek Show since way back.
Uh-huh. When did you jump ship?
No, I still listen.
Okay.
You're a good way to hear a new album check out.
Hey, man.
So I'll just.
I think labels should be paying me to do track by track of their album, but what do I know?
Yeah. If I want to hear an album, I'll just wait until you put it out, you know, and then I'll check it out that way.
Want to hear the new Demi Lovato? Check out the last episode.
Oh, really?
Well,
Are you serious?
I didn't do a track by track. I did it during the donation segment. I played a lot of songs.
I would listen to that.
I might do a track by track of it. We'll see. I had a joke that my podcast would now be banned because I'm playing Demi Lovato on the podcast. But yeah.
I just showed my daughter earlier. I showed her the Stevie Stiletto record. I was like, that's the guy who's interviewing me later.
Oh, with the girl on all fours? Is that the one with the girl?
No, I don't have that. I have Food for Flies.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's a rarity.
I have food. I don't have Smell the Sock.
I sold I sold that test press for Food for Flies for $600.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I have everything like that. But I have the Flexa Pleasers.
Oh, wow. That's definitely a rarity.
What You Deserve CD.
Oh, wow.
That's why I found your podcast in the first place, because I like the American Heartbreak.
Oh, that's good. Well, appreciate it, friend. Oh. All right, BJ, good luck with the book. Again, the book is called This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick by Brian J. Cramp. And I will post links on rockandrollgeek.com. I'm going to close out with a song. I'm going to let you pick the Cheap Trick song. Don't you pick any song. It doesn't have to be a Cheap Trick song. Pick the one that will get me banned from podcasting if you want.
Yeah, I think the real episode that got me in trouble was I did an episode called Headbangers Ball where I recreated an episode of Headbangers Ball where I had the audio of the episode and I just put all the songs in where the videos were.
I have a feeling they were just trying to get a settlement from Podbean. They were just trying to fuck with Podbean because they figured Podbean had money.
Maybe. What's a song? I don't know. The first song that came to mind is the song "Zap" by Ginger from that solo album he had.
Oh, yeah, let me see if I can find Ginger. That's Hell's a Poppin'. Heads a Poppin'.
Yeah, that song "Zap" from there.
Let me see. Who's this called?
One of his greatest songs ever.
Okay, let me see if I can find Ginger. You want to stick around for the song, or you don't have to, BJ, if you don't want. Do you hear me, BJ?
Yeah, okay.
You want to see?
I can jump off.
All right.
I actually have to go to work tonight.
What do you do for a living?
I work in a warehouse.
You stock pallets?
No, I fill orders for the stores at the Walgreens distribution center.
There you go, friends. Go to your Walgreens distribution center. You might have a published author working there too, friends.
Yeah, I'm definitely the only published author that works there.
Hey, I would think that that could be a, I mean, you're married, but if you were single, that would be a good, a good pickup line. All right, BJ, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I'll talk
thanks,
to you.
Thanks, Michael.
All right.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
There you go, BJ Cramp. It is a really good book, friends, and I will post links where you can purchase it. This Band Has No Past by Brian J. Cramp. All right, I'm going to close out with a song by Ginger Wildheart from Heads of Poppin' called Zap. Thank you for listening. This is going to go right out on Sunday. I may also post a Notes from the Tree Stand that I did this morning. It was quite nerve-wracking up there on the tree stands. I may post that later. You may get a bonus episode today, but in the meantime, thank you for listening to Day 21, Dog Days of Podcasting. Here's Ginger Wildheart, song called Zap. I will talk to you tomorrow, friends.
Tempting for a week or two, then it ends. Au revoir, wiedersehen. My head is on the fritz again. Fireworks are going off inside my yeah.
It's a rock and roll geek train wreck.